Thank you very, very much. And I'm very honored and very pleased to be here, thanks to the Siemens Foundation and also Humboldt University. As Professor Macho just said, it's the university where someone I spent a lot of time thinking about Hegel taught, and it's always had a very special, there's a room over there I know where Hegel used to teach, and I've been in that room and felt the vibrations there. And I feel them here again. So I'm very glad to be here to talk to you about this issue, which is a really big issue in our world. I'm talking about what it means to say that our Western democratic societies, or sometimes people say democratic societies in general, ought to be secularist. Or if we're speaking, this happens in two languages, because a certain number of countries like France and Italy and Spain and Turkey have this other word, laïcité, or laiklik in Turkish, or which is the word that they use, and they're not quite exactly translations of each other, but still they're pointing to the same basic issues. And what I'd like to do tonight is propose two ways of understanding what these issues are. Why do we need, and I think we do need, secularist regimes in diverse liberal societies? Two ways of looking at why we need them and what the issues are. And I will, of course, very strongly take a position for one of them rather than the other. So it isn't going to be a neutral, value-free discourse. It's going to be very much my own position. I think we can define these two understandings of secularism in terms of what they're seen as doing, what they're designed for. Why do we need such a regime? Now, there's one view that says that we need a regime of that kind, which involves separation of church and state and a non-alignment of the state with any particular religion, because we need, in a liberal society, somehow to control religion, to make sure it keeps to its proper place. And this is the kind of view that you could easily take if you looked at the history of, for instance, French laïcité, the famous law of 1905 on la séparation de l'Église et de l'État. You can see there from the whole way in which it was conceived that the big problem was the place of the Catholic Church and how to somehow keep it from invading totally the Republic and give it and confine it to a certain space. So that's what, let me call that, and maybe that's somewhat unfair of me, but let's call that the control model, religion control model. That's one model. The other model, which also goes back a long time, is what I want to call the diversity model. And there, the big problem that secularist regimes are meant to deal with is the issue of how to deal with a diverse society, which is also a democratic society, and as a democratic society, has to be a society founded on equality. So how to somehow cope with diversity in the context of democracy and equality of different citizens, that's the big problem that the second concept, the second idea, sees secularism as dealing with. So let's call them the control model, religion control model, and the diversity model, A and B. Now, I think that a great deal of our world thinks in terms of the control model. And that's, I mean, our Western world, and that's partly because of our history. I think we have to see that the two big societies which have been taken, I think maybe unfairly, but have been taken as the kind of paradigm societies are the USA and France of this issue of secularism. And you can see in the French case why, I just mentioned it a minute ago, but everybody can understand why the religion control way of looking at things was prominent in the French case. They had this tremendous battle between two visions of what the French identity or what France really was all about. And one was the vision of France as a Catholic monarchy, and this lasted well after the fall of the monarchy. We're talking about the time of the Dreyfus case, the end of the 19th and early 20th centuries, where the Action Française and Maurras was saying, France will only be great again when it returns to its roots as a Catholic monarchy. Of course, he was himself a Kantian atheist, but I mean, he had this view that for the sake of France, that should be the regime. And on the other hand, you had the whole Republican movement that said, no, on the contrary, how France should properly be and how it can become great is by the rights of the human rights, the rights of man, liberty, equality, fraternity. And these two were engaged in a tremendous struggle for hegemonic control of the French state. And of course, the Republicans won, but the kind of law that they passed was a law which was a kind of victory over this alternative, this alternative threatening model. And as a matter of fact, that's been part of the problem, as we'll see when we come to contemporary France. Although the actual law that was passed in 1905 was much more moderate than you might glean from looking at this history. And the other case is the American case. Now, the American case is actually very interesting, because the American case started off really in my second model, in the diversity model. You had a situation in which almost everybody was some kind of Protestant Christian or some kind of deist related to Protestant Christianity, people like Jefferson and so on. But within that general agreement or general fact about about America at the very beginning, there were these different churches. And so what they did was, by passing the First Amendment to the Constitution and denying the possibility of establishing any church in America, they were taking the line of a diversity model. They were saying, how can we live together? We have all these different confessional options. And as a matter of fact, in those days, there were established churches in the states, and that remained for quite a while. But at the federal level, they said, we have to be able to live together. So you had a diversity model, which was first of all adopted. This is very interesting. So America at its origins, I'm talking about the Constitution making, I'm talking about the First Amendment, which allowed the Constitution actually to be ratified in 1787, 88. This was a diversity model, but it had this great difficulty that it was diversity among Christian, or really Protestant churches, and then America faced the great diversification. Catholics came, Jews were there, but eventually became to be recognized. People of no religion sprung up there and rejected all religions and so on. America became much more diversified. And then you had a kind of crisis which operated over a great number of decades, where the definition of this society as Christian, although with different churches, gradually came under pressure. But you had judgments made by judges in the 1820s and 30s, which said, you know, America is a Christian country, and therefore, etc. They just took that as one of the premises of adjudication. And finally, there was a battle in which the people who held strongly to this Christian identity wanted finally to write it into the Constitution, America is a Christian country. And there was a big battle in the 1870s and 1880s, and that was defeated. Now, when that was defeated, the word secularism began to be used in the American case. It hadn't been used before. Separation of church and state was used. The idea of there being no established religion was used. But secularism wasn't. So secularism itself entered the U.S. vocabulary in a context of, again, struggle against what was now not a hegemonic church, but a hegemonic religion, right? So secularism coming out of these two great model societies, America and France, has acquired, in both these languages of English and French, has acquired a certain resonance of what I'm calling model one, the model of control of religion. But now I'd like to claim that in spite of that, going against the current of this resonance, what we really need today is model two, the model which sees secularism as what kind of a regime we need to deal with the fact of diversity in democracies. I'm going to lay out this model. As a matter of fact, I see my colleague Rajiv Bhargava here, who has been one of the people who's contributed to this view that I'm presenting, though I may not agree with the detail of it, really thinking of it in terms of Indian experience. But I think we need to look at our Western experience in this light. And this way of looking at it really starts from the issue, well, what are our goals? What are the principles we're trying to operate on? What are we trying to maximize? And I think you can do this in two or three or four. I'll propose to you three principles, three goals, which I think secularist regimes are trying to or ought to be trying to maximize. Number one, the freedom of conscience of everyone, religious or non-religious or anti-religious, to act out their own convictions. I mean, it may be wearing a headscarf if you're some kind of Muslim, or maybe wearing a kippah if you're some kind of Jew, or maybe wearing a cross, or maybe doing something totally different if you're not of any religion. But freedom of conscience is one of the basic principles. The second principle is equality between citizens of whatever view they might have about religion, non-religion, or anti-religion. They all are equal citizens of the society, which means that the society itself, the state itself, can't be aligned with any of these views. And the third principle is a principle about, if you like, politics rather than the law. It's the principle that we ought to try to ensure that all the different metaphysical, religious, anti-metaphysical, anti-religious positions are equally heard when it comes to deciding big issues of how we should live together. In other words, all these voices should somehow be in the debate. It's a little bit of a stretch, but in order to make it easier to remember these three, I just appeal to the great trinity of values, liberté, égalité, fraternité, liberty, equality, fraternity. Fraternity is maybe a bit of a stretch for my number three, but it's not entirely unrelated. I mean, making sure that everybody has a voice in the debate is a kind of, as it were, working out of the value of fraternity. And certainly, liberty and equality apply to the first two. So, these are the goals. But I haven't spoken yet about about things like separation of church and state. I haven't spoken about the neutrality of the state. This is not because these structures are considered unimportant by the second model. No. But it's simply because things like the separation of church and state and the neutrality of the state are very, very slippery concepts which need to be interpreted in each given context. And the basic way of thinking of my second model is that we should define the separation of church and state, and we should define neutrality in the light of these three goals. That is, the way the institutional structures that best meet the three goals ought to be the ones that we will define as separation of church and state. Now, why do I favor this second view over the first? Well, I think there are two very, very big advantages which flow from it. Number one is, when you lay out the three goals, as I've just done, it's clear that they can conflict. They're different goals, and in certain situations, they can enter into tension with each other. In other words, we can see right away that there can be dilemmas, big dilemmas, which we have somehow to resolve. I mean, take a very discussed case, which is very discussed in Canada and the commission I was on. It has been discussed in France, has been raised in Germany. The issue of young girls in schools, Muslim girls wearing a hijab, right? And as you know, this has been denied in the French schools. In Germany, if I understand it rightly, of course, it depends on the different Länder, but in some Länder, I don't think it's any Land which has made which is, were forbidden schoolgirls from wearing the hijab, but some have said that teachers, female Muslim teachers who ought to wear the hijab, should not be allowed to do that in the classroom. And then in other cases, such as the UK, for instance, to stay within Europe, there is no general rule against either teachers or students. Now, what's going on here? Why are there different reactions here? Well, because people feel, I think underlying all this, that there is a dilemma here. On one hand, you have the value, the goal of freedom of conscience. And that would tell you to accept or to allow this wherever people wanted to wear it, felt they had to wear it, felt it was part of their exercise of their religion to wear it. On the other hand, you have this sense that, after all, institutions like public schools are public institutions. They belong to the state. They are part of, they're there to serve all of us. These institutions have in some way not to be aligned, to be neutral, right? So that's why people hesitate to follow their first instinct, which might be looking at freedom to say, let them do it. They say, well, no, we have to have a neutral school system, so we must forbid it. And whereas you can get all sorts of solutions here, the solution you have in certain German Länder is that, all right, we let the kids do it, the school children do it. But after all, people argue, teacher is a kind of authority figure, and therefore we can't let the teachers do it. Well, now, just to let you in on, I mean, part of the thinking for this comes from a commission we had in Quebec between 2007 and 2008 about all these issues, and our conclusion was that both should be allowed to wear it. I mean, we didn't take as ultimately valid the argument that teachers are authority figures and therefore they shouldn't wear it, because we argued on the other direction on that. We said, look, we want to bring these children up in a world in which they're going to be surrounded by very, very diverse religious positions. And they better learn that quite early on, that some teachers will have a veil and some won't. I mean, a very small minority like you have a veil, but you know, they will have a veil and some won't. And that's the world that they're living in. So we decided against that. But you can see that you need an argument here. You need an argument because you're faced with what at first blush is a dilemma. And you need to work it out. And you need not only to work it out, but probably you'll work it out differently in different situations because the contours of different situations, the pressures of different countries and so on are going to be different. So it's not likely that we'll ever have a single agreed answer to this dilemma across all the different democratic jurisdictions of the West, right? So, but the important thing is to recognize that there are two principles here and there's a dilemma. The problem with conceptions like laïcité, as it very often is, or like the separation of church and state, as it very often is presented, is that it's presented as the obvious answer to this before you even ask the question. And people ask things like, well, what solution is more purely laïque, right? What solution is more purely separating church and state? You ask the question as though it were a single, there were a single principle, and the issue was only to see how to put it into practice in the most thoroughgoing way. And I think that that is a deep intellectual mistake which underlies this religion control view, that we ought to bring out the inherent dilemmas. I would even say that the way in which concepts like laïcité are used very often, as you can see this in the French debate around the Stasi Commission, is that they're almost fetishized as concepts that have to do with our republican tradition. And that stops people being able to think out the underlying dilemmas. This is a very important thing I'm going to come back to later and talking at another level about this, about how we're really involved here in thinking out dilemmas. So this is one very important superiority to me, today anyway, of the diversity view over the religion and control view, that it allows you to get clear what the issues are. And the second very important superiority of this view, I think, is that it makes clear that the neutrality we're looking for is a neutrality not just between religions, but a neutrality between religion and non-religion, between religion and anti-religion. Right? It's, if you think of it purely in religion and control terms, then you can easily slide into forgetting that and thinking, for instance, if we take the Turkish case, as it was up till recently, very fortunately there are some big changes going on in Turkey, but as it was in what I consider to be the bad old days from up to about 10 years ago, when the army would from time to time fire the government because it was not sufficiently keeping to the Kemalist principle of laiklik, of laïcité. And a lot of people in the West, in France and elsewhere, said, that's wonderful. These people take their laïcité seriously. But from the standpoint of the second model that I'm talking about, this was a travesty of, because you had, first of all, a church, in this case, the Sunni Islam, completely controlled by the government, where all the teaching of imams is controlled by government ministry. You had a society in which more heterodox forms of Islam didn't really have a right to exist openly, but Alevi couldn't found mosques, so they could meet in various kinds of places to worship together. In other words, you had, in all sorts of ways, a tremendously biased government controlling the majority of religion, denying certain ways of expressing it, and so on. Nothing like the kind of neutrality that ought to exist in a society which is secular, according to the second model, according to the model of, as it were, managing democratically diversity. So you can see that in these two very important ways, in the fact that one doesn't really get to pose the dilemmas, and in the fact that we can easily slide into thinking that a government that simply controls religion is a secular government, even though it is not, it is controlling religion precisely and not really separating church and state. So it seems to me that this is obviously a better form. And now let's go back and look at this history, the history that comes out of America of the 1870s, the history that comes out of the France of the 1900s, and the history of struggling against a possible hegemonic move by either a church in France or by a religious belief, I mean, which spread out over many churches in the United States. Is that our problem today? And I would argue that it's not. On the contrary, every one of our countries in the West is becoming more and more diverse religiously, for a whole lot of, religiously or ideologically or spiritually or however you want to describe it. I mean, part of it is migration. People are coming in who weren't represented before, Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, and so on, in any great numbers, and now they are. But also within these societies, people are taking their own spiritual paths, some of them inspired by religions from elsewhere. So you have in Western societies today a much more diversified population. So it seems clear to me that the historical development, even if, as it were, the model number one, the control model, there was a moment in which it was the relevant model. This moment has long since passed, right? Well, let me perhaps now look at some objections to that, because I think one has to do that. I'm talking here out of an experience that certainly makes, tremendous sense in Quebec, tremendous sense in Canada, tremendous sense in other societies of the Western Hemisphere that I know. But I know that in Europe today, there are grave doubts about this, grave doubts about the lack of necessity, if you like, to control religion. This is fear around Islam, around certain extreme positions taken by certain Islamic citizens or Islamic thinkers. And so you might say that, it could be argued, that the possibility of this second regime, of this regime of organized around diversity, only exists where there is a very deep and widespread consensus about the rules of a secular society. I mean, precisely the rules that I outlined as definitive of this second model, that the three goals are freedom, conscience, equality, and making sure that everyone is heard. And of course, behind that stands the whole, as it were, schedule of human rights, which are now written into more and more constitutions in the modern world, more and more democratic constitutions. But what if, some people say, what if there are people, and this is what suspicion that very often hangs over Muslim fellow citizens in Europe, who are not accepting this, who are challenging this, who want to change this, who will not accept equality, for instance, between men and women, which is a very crucial part of equality. And here, my position could easily be, I'll make the following objection from a European point of view to my position that I've just outlined, that it's fine for Canada, for Quebec, but does it work for Europe? And the reason why that might look tempting as a position is that it's true that we have a controlled immigration. I'm even somewhat perhaps ashamed of this, it's very egoistic, but we only accept people into Canada who have a certain number of qualifications, who know certain languages, who have degrees or have qualifications to practice this or that skill. And so it's a very carefully selected immigration. The result is, I'm going to look at Quebec for a minute because I'm, you know, obviously very familiar with this because of our commission, that if you take, and in Quebec we have this policy, which is very important to us because of the preservation of the French language, of favoring immigration from certain societies where we know that the people either know French or will easily learn French. And so there are lots of immigrants from Lebanon, from the Maghreb in North Africa, for instance, that come to Quebec, and lots of Muslim immigrants. Now, the Muslim immigrants in Quebec are twice as likely to have tertiary education as the mean of the native population. They're much better educated, they're much more highly skilled than the population as a whole. And this has meant that we have a population of immigrants that is, in a certain sense, already has, you know, elective affinities, Wahlverwandtschaft, with our Canadian way of life, with our liberal way of life. Whereas in the European case, there's been a lot of immigrants from Muslim countries who have come without those skills. But more importantly, they came, in many cases, including the case of this country, with an unfortunate understanding of what they were doing here. I mean, what, and this was a bilateral mistake, if you like. It wasn't just the German society or it wasn't just the immigrants, it was both together. The very notion of Gastarbeiter is a notion of someone who's here for a while and is going to go back. Now, this sometimes existed in Western Hemisphere societies. I mean, sometimes immigrants came with the idea that from Italy, I'm going to make money and then I'm going to go home to my village and I'm going to set up a nice hotel and so on. It very rarely turned out that way. And most people really recognized that from the beginning. And the receiving societies, let's say the United States, Canada, Argentina, Brazil, you name it, the receiving societies never saw the things that way. You know, they saw these people, they're coming here, they're going to be here forever with their children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. And that's why, you know, in the case of Canada, we wanted to open up the Great West and so on. That's why they were received. So the general understanding was they're going to become, as fast as possible, Canadians, Quebecois, Americans, Argentinians, Brazilians, whatever. And this was not the understanding in many European countries at first. And this produced a very unfortunate result that great efforts weren't made on both sides often to make sure that they had the kind of skills and capacities that would allow them to flourish over generations, right? I mean, particularly the kind of effort which is made just routinely in Canada and Quebec to make sure that the small children learn English or French was not always made in Germany or Holland or elsewhere. And now, the result was a situation in which a lot of people who came in here and thought they were going back but didn't, and their children and their grandchildren, have sometimes felt alienated. They felt that they haven't really established themselves in this society. They've had difficulty identifying with it. I mean, this is not simply the case of Germany and Holland. Think of the case in France as well, where in spite of this tremendous emphasis in France on cultural assimilation, nevertheless, it came about that a lot of people in the dans les banlieues parisiennes just never got the skills and never got the chance and never got employed and so on. So there's a great deal of alienation and anger out there, which we saw exploding in 2005 in the autumn, if you remember, in the banlieue parisienne and elsewhere where people were burning cars and so on, right? Now, so there is a situation in which integration of the kind that has been generally successful in the Western Hemisphere has not happened always in Europe. And I must say the lesson has been learned in many countries. I mean, it's in many Länder in Germany, in many Länder in Austria, in Vienna, certainly. The effort is being made to make sure that these kids go to kindergarten. I mean, they weren't formerly, they didn't have to go to kindergarten and they weren't encouraged to go to kindergarten and they never really learned the skills in German so that when they went into first grade, they really could keep up with everybody else. And now this is more and more seen to be crucial. And I think that is that's the key to a situation which otherwise could look very grim. Why is it the key to the situation? Well, because the property of our societies, now I want to speak about the whole West together, I mean Germany and Canada and the United States and elsewhere, is that they have a tremendous attraction for people from outside because they offer something very important. We asked a lot of the people we spoke to, when I'm talking we, the commission in Quebec, we asked a lot of people, why did you come here? Why did you want to come to Canada, Quebec, and so on? There were two answers that kept coming up. One was freedom. we can have the freedoms that, and this is people not coming from Europe, this is people coming from the Maghreb, for instance, freedom. We can have the kind of freedoms we don't have at home. But the second one, which was equally important, was our children. By that they meant we feel that we can offer our children here the kind of start in life, the kind of education, which would allow them to go way beyond what we could have hoped for. And this is even coming from people who had middle-class jobs but wanted, you know, their children to get even sort of better, higher education and even better jobs, and so on. These are the two reasons why the society that they came to appealed to them, and even when they were very angry about this, that, or the other, these were reasons that still drew them. Now, these are what, and we hope, all of our rich Western societies can offer those who come in. And this is a tremendously powerful draw. So that the desire to be part of these societies, to become integral to them, to take on basically their understanding of life and how society should operate, this desire is latent and very powerful in a lot of people who come here. It's only overcome or beaten back by the bad experience of not really succeeding in integrating. And that is, I think, the biggest reason why there has been a negative reaction. There's one more reason I want to come to in a minute, which is the whole, it applies particularly to Muslims, the whole geopolitical situation. We've got ourselves into a kind of geopolitical rut in which we have this idea of a clash of civilizations, which is terribly popular, and we're now in a new situation in a globalized world where working things out within our society between different groups is very often bedeviled by the relationships as understood on a geopolitical level, the war in Iraq, the war against terror, and so on. But leave that aside for a minute. One of the main reasons why there are still very deep strains and tensions and alienations in many Western societies, I would argue, is not because of the religious difference, though it very often can take forms that are rationalized by that once it arises, but because the promise of these societies, which makes them tremendously attractive, if the promise can be realized, seems blocked in such cases. I mean, I think the clearest case in which this is true is the French case, where you have this very powerful alienation of really Muslim origin youth, but they're not, in general, extremely biased or believing, or they have a reaction of what they feel very often is a despised Muslim origin identity. They have developed, which is of course the capital crime in French culture, they've developed their own algo, their own language, Verlan, and so on, which is a kind of very strange transformer French with a lot of Arab words and so on. That's a sign of standing outside the mainstream of French society. But this has not been caused by the differences between Islam and Christianity or Islam and Western liberalism. It's been caused by this great the breakdown of the actual integration process, right? So, but let's go back and look at the kinds of issues that are raised in a society like the Netherlands, for instance, where there is this, has been some terrible actions, the killing of Theo van Gogh and so on, carried out in the name of supposedly Islamic fundamentalism. And here's where we have another one of these dilemmas we have to think in terms of. On one hand, a liberal society can't permit this kind of action, the murder of someone because they made a film that, you know, that is not respectful enough to whatever view it is, just as they cannot permit the murder of Salman Rushdie. And a number of other things of this kind cannot be permitted. And this is something that has to be very clearly communicated. On the other hand, there is goal number three of the model I'm talking about, which is making sure, bringing about that all these voices are heard. In other words, that means bringing these minorities into the debate and discussion of how to run our liberal society. And this does set up a dilemma, because there are ways of giving the first message, you can't do this here, which give a negative view on the second message, which really says you aren't welcome here, right? Now, I mean, extreme case is, you know, Le Pen in France, is Geert Wilders in the Netherlands, who wants to ban the Quran. You see, what you have there is exactly the kind of hole that we're in danger of falling into it. And we're also in danger in North America, because I think Islamophobia is the big disease which is likely to, madness, I should say, which is endangering our societies. It's turned into, I mean, the whole reading of why these criminal behaviors arise is turned into an issue of the fundamental essence of Islam as against Christianity or as against Western secular Enlightenment society, which of course is absurd when you look at the whole of Islam over history and over geography, but is also something which is likely to become a self-fulfilling prophecy. That is, there are people that are working to take that alienation and interpret it and turn it into something which is against the West, as it were, coming from a Muslim objection to the West. And the kind of reaction with people like Wilders is just strengthening that and building into that. It's making that alienation something unovercomable. So let me go back to the objection I think could be made to my second model. People might say it works all very well. It works well in Canada, in Quebec, in the America, and so on, but it won't work here because of these profound resistances we find among some Muslims in Europe. But I think that's the wrong lesson to draw from these resistances. And if you begin to read them as something intrinsic to the religion, you see, and therefore want to slide back into the religion-controlling model, right? If this really were something kind of intrinsic to Islam, that they would want to violate all these basic rules of our society, then, of course, we're back in the situation analogous to France in 1905, right? We're, except a much smaller group, of course, than a hegemonic church, but we're back in that kind of posture. And I think, therefore, this misreading of the actual problems that are posed to European societies by new migrants is one that's in the nature of a self-fulfilling prophecy, one that's not grounded in the real situation and the real causation and the real causes that brought this about, but is one is likely to make them very much worse. So what are we looking, if you take this model, what does it really require in the end? If you think of the ideal point, which we'll never reach, where it's fully, as it were, operative, it would be a world in which we come together as a majority in a society around certain basic principles, the principles of human rights and equality, and the secularist regime as described in the second model would be part of those principles, would be integral part of those principles. But this is not something which this is something we share, but we don't share the fundamental reasons why each of us, for his or her own part, accepts this. We accept that human beings have the right to life. The Christian will say this is because they're made in the image of God. The Kantian will say because they're rational beings. The utilitarian will say because they are beings that can suffer and be happy, and therefore that's, you know, they ought to be given this, and there's no reason to deny them this, and so on. So we will have this great variety of reasons spread out in the population for our coming together on these same principles. And there's something a little bit unsettling about this, because we've always been used in our history, in Christendom, to have the basic principles of the society anchored in what was understood to be the basic nature of the good. If you go back to 200 years, all our societies were confessional societies. I mean, talking about Europe now. I mean, the United States was already beginning to break out of that. But in Europe, in Germany, two confessions or three confessions, depending on how you count, in different areas of the country. So we lived in a world in which it seemed normal that the basic principles on which the state operates were grounded in generally accepted foundations. Lutheran here, Calvinist there, Catholic there, and so on, Anglican, etc. And it's very hard to move out of that. But this is what this second kind of secular regime requires. See, the first secularist regime doesn't yet move us out of that, because there's a certain version of Jacobinism which simply makes the Jacobin lay Enlightenment republicanism the religion of the state, right? It makes it the non-religion, but the common ideology of the state. So it's once more a kind of civil religion which is dominant. And I think when you hear the debates in Paris around the Stasi Commission, you hear echoes of that idea still coming back. But that's something that can't be accepted if you take seriously this second model, right? So we have to, we're in a world in which the most fundamental principles of the state, we can hope, will be agreed by almost everyone, but for reasons that will be very different from one case to the next. And I think this is the only kind of stable democratic regime that we in the West could ever hope for. Now, if people want to say that there are certain conditions in which the disagreements are so great that we can't have that, then I think I don't see another democratic solution. But I think it would be much too early to conclude that in any of the cases of the Western world, Western Europe right through to the Americas, we're dealing with cases of this kind. I think, on the contrary, this should be the model that we should embrace. So I presented my case. Maybe it's the time to have some discussion. Und ich sollte sagen, vielleicht, dass ich habe auf Englisch vorgetragen und das war vielleicht schade. Aber wenn Sie eine Frage auf Deutsch stellen wollen, das wäre...